we are producing oil, but we subject the sales of our oil to American dollar, price them in dollar.
Pockets of protests over the economic hardship have started springing up in some Nigerian cities. Meanwhile, the Nigerian Labour Congress has called for a two-day nationwide strike on 27 and 28 February in protests over the rising cost of living.
The Nigerian government has promised to take proactive steps to mitigate the economic problems people are facing. Experts, however, say the government should first solve the persistent insecurity in Nigeria to be able to focus on agriculture for food security. They also say human capacity must be developed so that the Nigerian population becomes an asset instead of a liability. Tanjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
As the assault on Gaza escalates again with the death toll since October 7 nearing 30,000, pro-Palestinian protests are gaining momentum in Canada. During nationwide rallies, protesters criticized Prime Minister Justin Trudeau for his inaction.
Palestinian.
On the cusp of the Israeli invasion of the southernmost city of Gaza, Rafah, the people of Take to the Streets joining cities across Canada, calling on their government to take measures to stop Israel's genocide of the Palestinian people.
I'm here to ask for ceasefire right now. Enough is enough. It has been taking a long time for our government to stand up and call for ceasefire. This is not the right way to do it. We have to get arms embargo.
I'm at a loss for words, to be honest, but what's going on, it's the end of the line. It's a death camp, and we want to, again, pressure our politicians, pressure our communities, hands off Rafah.
Although the government of Canada has called for a ceasefire, demonstrators noted that since October, Ottawa has approved $28.5 million of military exports to Israel. They see this, along with the refusal of the Canadian government to call the assault on Gaza genocide, tantamount to a stab in the back of the public's demands. Robert N. Lakesh, Calgary.
Tens of thousands of farmers are standing their ground on the outskirts of New Delhi ahead of planned crucial talks. The Farmers' March comes 2 years after similar protests that lasted for a year against new agricultural reforms that were later scrapped by the government of Premier Modi. As general elections are due in the coming months, the farmers are mounting pressure on the government, demanding legislation that would guarantee minimum support price for their produce.
We are protesting to guarantee prices for our crops. The previous government had schemes in support of farmers, but the present government is making laws which are against farmers and not acceptable to us. They want to sell India's agriculture sector to corporations, but we will protest till our demands are met.
The protesting farmers are mostly from the neighboring state of Punjab and Haryana. They say rising cultivation costs and debts have led them to increase their production of crops. Therefore, a guaranteed minimum support price for their produce would stabilize their income. They're also demanding the government fulfill its election pledge to double farmers' income and waive their loans and withdraw any legal case filed against them during earlier protest.
This government wants to destroy us. All the promises before elections turned futile. We want debt waivers, pensions for farmers and laborers, and the withdrawal of all legal cases filed against protesting farmers during the 2021 March. We are peacefully marching towards the capital, but the government is using tear gas to stop us as if we are outsiders. But we will fight till our demands are fulfilled.
Since the march started, several meetings between leaders of farmers and government ministers have ended inconclusively. The ministers of Modi's government, however, expect a peaceful solution. The two sides are expected to meet soon, as Prime Minister Modi has already said his government is working on more inclusive schemes to benefit farmers. His party also claims to have already doubled the minimum support price from 1,000 to 2,000 Indian rupees, a claim that farmers deny. The protests come at a time when the country is gearing up for general elections in few months' time. The farmers are seen as an important section of the voting population. Experts say Modi is expected to secure a third term, despite the protest. They say it is, however, crucial to strike a deal with the protesting farmers to secure a long-term solution, since successive governments have failed to appease them. Most of the vital roads leading to the capital, New Delhi, have been fortified, like this one. And massive barricades have been erected across all sides of the border to make sure the protesters are confined to outside the city. Tens of thousands of farmers are camping just a few miles away from the capital. They say they will keep marching to the capital unless there is a breakthrough in negotiations. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Anger in the streets of London. Another mass protest. A turnout of hundreds of thousands. Veteran campaigners, young activists, British Jewish groups.
It's the fourth national demonstration of the year and the second one to end outside the Israeli embassy here in London. And their message, these protesters say, is clear. Stop the genocide now.
That's what they have been demanding for more than 4 months now. And the impending Israeli incursion into the southern Gaza city of Rafah, that shelters more than 1.5 million Palestinians, accounts for today's turnout, one of the largest since it all began.
We're watching these messages, we're watching these videos of people getting slaughtered on a daily basis, but we're not insensitized to this. The Western media, the Western world is desensitized to this. We won't. We will stand for our Palestinian brothers and sisters in Gaza, in the West Bank, wherever, to get rid of this cancer that is Zionism, and we're going to fight until the day that Palestine is free.
A free Palestine is yet to come. But there is a chance for British politicians to stop the ongoing mass slaughter. On February 21st, MPs, representatives of the British public, will be voting on a second ceasefire motion. The first such vote, November last year, didn't pass muster. We asked Ben Jamal of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign what message a no vote would send to the Palestinians.
It will deliver a message to the Palestinian people that the British Parliament says your lives don't matter. The message we've delivered today is that they do matter to the British people, and that now the British Parliament needs to start listening to what the British people are saying.
The political party's position on Israel's genocidal war on Gaza has taken center stage in this year's upcoming general elections in the UK. And the protesters here say it determines which way their vote will go. Saeed Purizza, London.
Supporters of the jailed Pakistani former Premier Imran Khan and his party, Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf or PTI, held nationwide protests on Saturday to condemn alleged manipulation in the February 8 general election.
The mandate that the people of Pakistan has given the independent, so-called independent candidates, backed by none other than PTI, because our election symbol was taken away, our entire leadership is behind jails with sham, aapke jo mukadmaat hai. So this doesn't make any sense. When the people have spoken, they have to be respected. Otherwise, they will be on the street, it will be chaos, and no government, no political party will be able to rule.
Supporters of Imran Khan's party insist that widespread electoral manipulation has deprived their party of achieving 2/3 majority in the parliament.
I voted for Imran Khan, but I'm speaking as a Pakistani. As a Pakistani voter, I voted, I was there at 7:45 in the morning. I wanted to be first in line so that I could vote. By evening, our candidate was winning, everything was fine. 3 in the morning, suddenly the man lost, and he lost by 20,000 votes or God knows something like that. How is this possible? This is not possible and this is not acceptable.
However, Imran Khan's rival political group, Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, says the PTI party tried to derail democracy by creating controversy around elections. A dramatic change in the political climate occurred when the commissioner of Rawalpindi, a city in northern Pakistan, tendered his resignation, citing a guilty conscience for his role in enabling widespread electoral manipulation in the garrison city.
We converted the losers into winners with 70,000 votes margin. The chief election commissioner and chief justice are involved in poll fraud. I accept all the responsibility. I should be hanged. I cannot participate in the crime that could destroy Pakistan.
This is while Pakistan's election commission has rejected claims made by the Rawalpindi commissioner, stating that no official of the electoral body gave any direction to him regarding the manipulation of results.
The outcry over alleged vote rigging in the recently held elections for national and state legislatures has sparked widespread protests among multiple political factions. Analysts warn that the absence of a clear mandate for any political party could lead to prolonged political instability and hinder efforts to address economic challenges of the country. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Guarding the homeland against the threats from above. Iran's defense ministry has unveiled advanced air defense systems, further strengthening its position as one of the few countries that have acquired the technology involved in the detection, tracking, interception, and destruction of attacking missiles, both long-range and short-range.
Today, we are witnessing major achievements that have significantly increased our defense capabilities. The Arman anti-ballistic missile defense system is named after martyr Arman Adiverdi. It is classified as a tactical air defense system. Arman is equipped with a domestically made Sayyad 3 class, and it is capable of simultaneously detecting and tracking 24 targets at a distance ranging from 120 to 180 kilometers.
This new cutting-edge defensive weapon is also equipped with a self-protection system that makes it immune to potential low-altitude threats. The Arman defense system's radars and missile launchers have been incorporated into a single vehicle to enhance agility in defensive operations, allowing it to engage in operation in less than 3 minutes.
Azarakhsh, the other system we are unveiling today, is a low-altitude defense system. It's considered a versatile defense weapon that can be installed on different types of vehicles. This adds to its mobility and makes it ideal for agile responses. Therefore, it can be used to provide security for protected areas.
The state-of-the-art technology applied in both of the newly unveiled military hardware enhances defensive posture and boosts deterrence to adversary aggression, significantly increasing Iran's air defense capabilities once they are added to the country's military fleet.
What you witness today is quite significant because defensive capabilities and air defense in particular can tip the scales in any aggression and war. That is why this kind of deterrence is crucial for our country, a lesson that we learned the hard way because before the Islamic Revolution, we used to import everything from other countries.
Iran has made remarkable breakthroughs in manufacturing a broad range of homegrown military hardware in line with the policy to strengthen its defense capabilities, a red line that will never be up for any kind of negotiation.
Iran has come a long way over the past 45 years in its defense capabilities, becoming fully self-sufficient, turning from a country that had to import the military hardware that it needed to one that today is producing all the military equipment that it needs and also developing new ones. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
In the United States, Congress has broken for winter recess without coming to an agreement on a nearly $100 billion weapons package, which would have funded wars in Israel, Ukraine, the Red Sea, Taiwan, and elsewhere for years. The bill had passed the Democrat-led Senate, but the Republican-majority House of Representatives refused to vote on it in a setback to President Joe Biden's war planning.
Let me be clear here again this morning.
The Republican-led House will not be jammed or forced into passing a foreign aid bill that was opposed by most Republican senators and does nothing to secure our own border.
Earlier this month, Biden unsuccessfully tried to force through a $120 billion war spending bill, which even cynically tried to win over Republicans with $20 billion in anti-immigrant border security spending. While top polling agencies have remained mostly silent on the issue so far this year, the most recent polls confirm that public support has plummeted for more weapons to fuel foreign wars. There is an increasingly vocal desire to end American warmongering abroad and to focus money, energy, and attention on the raft of post-pandemic and post-great financial crisis domestic problems.
The situation here on the ground is definitely can be radicalizing because people are not even being provided with any of the usual concessions that imperial nations oftentimes, you know, give their citizens to keep them distracted. They're just being left out there while, again, we are giving billions and trillions to other countries to fight wars that are supposedly on our behalf, and yet we don't get to have any input in that.
The Biden administration has repeatedly rejected any negotiated settlement to the Ukraine conflict and has no strings attached to its unshakable support of Tel Aviv. Many say it's just a matter of time before more weapons are eventually sent to Israel and Ukraine, despite the global outcry.
We have to remember that these wars go on until America is defeated. Eventually, the public turns against every war. The war keeps going until it's no longer useful to big business, and it's no longer useful to defeating our rivals and corralling world energy resources.
The failed bill explicitly prohibited any funds for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, which is the main humanitarian agency in Gaza. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
According to a recent survey, homelessness in the United States is an all-time high due to rising house prices and a decline in assistance given during the COVID-19 pandemic. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. America's national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. A growing number of Americans are ending up homeless as soaring rents in recent years squeeze their budgets, according to a 25th of January report from Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Roughly 653,000 people reported experiencing homelessness in January of 2023. Up roughly 12% from the same time a year earlier and 48% compared to 2015. Harvard University researchers said that marks the largest single-year increase in the country's unhoused population on record. Homelessness, longer problem in states like California and Washington has also increased in historically more affordable parts of the United States. Arizona, Ohio, Tennessee, and Texas have seen the largest growth in their unsheltered populations due to rising local house prices. That alarming jump in people struggling to keep a roof over their head came amid blistering inflation in 2021 and 2022, and as surging rental prices across the U.S. outpace worker wage gains. Although a range of factors can cause homelessness, high rents and the expiration of pandemic relief last year contributed to the spike in housing insecurity, the researchers found. According to the report, in the first years of the pandemic, renter protections, income support and housing assistance helped stave off a considerable rise in homelessness in the U.S. However, many of these protections ended in 2022, at a time when rents were rising rapidly and increasing numbers of migrants were prohibited from working in the U.S. As a result, the number of people experiencing homelessness jumped by nearly 71,000 in just 1 year. Rent in the United States has steadily climbed since 2001. In analyzing census and real estate data, the Harvard University researchers found that half of all U.S. households across income levels spent between 30% and 50% of their monthly pay on housing in 2022, defining them as cost-burdened. Some 12 million tenants were severely cost-burdened that year, meaning they spent more than half of their monthly pay on rent and utilities, up 14% from pre-pandemic levels. The Joint Center for Housing Studies said people earning between $45,000 and $74,999 per year took the biggest hit from rising rents. On average, 41% of their paycheck went towards rent and utilities. According to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, tenants should generally allocate no more than 30% of their income towards rent. According to online housing marketplace Rent, although the rental market is showing signs of cooling, the median rent in the United States was $1,964 in December of 2023, up 23% from before the pandemic. By comparison, government data shows inflation-adjusted weekly earnings for the median worker rose 1.7% between 2019 and 2023. The Harvard University report stated, rapidly rising rents combined with wage losses in the early stages of the pandemic have underscored the inadequacy of the existing housing safety net, especially in times of crisis. National broadcaster ABC News has also covered this story and tells us more. Thousands of volunteers across the United States spent a night in January canvassing their communities to look for people who may be experiencing homelessness as part of the government's annual point-in-time count. The count is required by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and its results can be used alongside other factors to determine funding. But some experts said those estimates have often not been accurate. Hannah Anderson with the Young Women's Church Association, YWCA, a point-in-time count organizer in Snohomish County, Washington, said, "We only have 1 day to get a snapshot of the homeless population. You can't be accurate when you're counting people for just 1 day." An ABC News analysis found that methods and resources vary from community to community, producing an inconsistent, piecemeal account that even the Department of Housing and Urban Development acknowledges underestimates the number of unhoused people. Eric Tars of the National Homelessness Law Center said, "The picture that the Department of Housing and Urban Development is getting, and that Congress is getting, and that the public is getting, isn't as clear as it could be and should be." The Department of Housing and Urban Development Secretary Marcia Fudge told ABC News in an interview that the count is just a sampling of the country's homelessness crisis. Marcia Fudge said, "It's not an exact science," noting that if methodologies change from year to year, it could cause problems. She added, "There's no other way at this point for us to count all the homeless people, so we just do a sample." Recently, Marcia Fudge announced the Department of Housing and Urban Development's largest funding award of its kind, $3.1 billion to homeless services providers across the country that will fund more than 7,000 projects. The recipients entered Department of Housing and Urban Development's funding competition last year with extensive applications that included their point-in-time count results, among other metrics. Homelessness experts and institutions have been raising concerns about the point-in-time count for many years. Still, guidance surrounding the count has remained largely the same since it was first implemented in the mid-2000s. At least every other year, each community receiving Department of Housing and Urban Development funding must conduct a point-in-time count of homeless population in January, a time when people may crowd into homes with friends or family as much as possible to escape the cold. The Department of Housing and Urban Development Secretary Marcia Fudge told ABC News she doesn't know why the agency requires the count to be conducted in January, but that it will continue this practice for the time being. Fudge added, "It doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense, because it's cold, it's hard to find people, and people are inside. But that's what has always historically been done, and we just continue to do it the way it's always been done."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Genocidal war, the world has been exposed to the Israeli atrocities on occupied Palestinian territories. The two colors of Israel have been exposed as an apartheid regime, from human rights violations, the destruction of properties, illegal settlements, and most notably, the right of Palestinians for self-determination. In this edition of the program, we will look at some of these violations that have taken place with the full backing of the U.S. and how the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, has helped bring these issues to the fore. Issues which have been outright rejected by the Israeli regime. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Paul Arudi is a co-founder of the Free Palestine Movement and a former U.S. government advisor who joins us from Berkeley, California. Also joining us is Peter Ford, who's a former British ambassador to Syria who joins us from Manchester. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. If you can set the stage for us, Paul Arudi, how Operation Al-Aqsa Flood was in many ways a result of the violations of Palestinians by the Israeli regime in the Gaza Strip that has happened throughout the years and decades, and how it built up to the fact that you had then had Palestinians in the Gaza Strip to be under a full blockade for 17 years, and then that was one of the reasons for this operation to have been executed.
Yes, that's correct. The isolation of the Palestinians, especially the Palestinians in Gaza, has been increasing over the years. It used to be that right after the 67 war, it was possible for Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank and in Israel itself to move relatively freely between all these different places. It was an opportunity which hadn't existed since 1948, and this was, although Israel was controlling everything, it was, in effect, this fact that permitted contacts between Palestinians who hadn't seen each other since 1948. But gradually they started to implement greater restrictions, building the wall, for example, on the West Bank, and the same thing around Gaza. And then when Hamas won the elections in 2007, or was it six? In any case, I think they were installed in January of 2007. And in June of 2007, Israel basically cut off all relations with the Gaza Strip, and they evacuated their settlements, and it became a concentration camp, an open air concentration camp.
All right. Well, Peter Ford, so here we have the ICJ, where it has convened for the second time. The first time was the case that was brought against the Israeli regime by South Africa. And then we're having this, which is different, even though it's the ICJ, but 52 countries in attendance, three international organizations. But the focus is, not the focus, but the theme, actually, is on the fact that you have the occupation. So it's questioning the Israeli regime altogether. How big a deal is that?
Well, what's happening this week at the ICJ is very important and very interesting. It's amazing to think that for decades, the legal position has not been clear with regard to the legality of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. And now, belatedly, thankfully, the ICJ is waking up and has been asked to give an opinion, not a ruling which would force Israel to comply, but an opinion on the legal aspects of the Israeli occupation. Now, this has thrown the Israelis very much onto the defensive, along with their US allies. It's intensely embarrassing for them, because the opinion can only go in one direction, which is to confirm the complete illegality of the Israeli presence on the West Bank and Gaza, and in particular, the illegality of the settlements which Israel has been building for decades in the West Bank. And therefore, they're throwing everything into attempts to discredit the ICJ, to throw sand in the eyes of the judges, but they are being shown up as being isolated. 52 countries are speaking in the course of the week, and only three, the United States, Israel, and curiously Fiji, are going to in any way defend the Israeli position. So their isolation is absolutely clear to the world.
And do you get the feeling, Paul LaRudy, that this time around, not that the first time when the ICJ convened didn't do it, but it just appears that there's a refresh button that has been pressed, where even when you take a look at the core slogan, not slogan, but the issues to be covered, quote, occupation, settlement, and annexation, as well as policies aimed at altering the demographic composition, character, and status of Al-Quds. That's what the website states, that refresh button has been now pushed, and that's what's being discussed.
Well, the situation of Jerusalem also becoming off limits to more and more Palestinians, and of Gaza, as we know, the genocide and so forth, is an attempt by Israel to go do more than just refresh what its statements in the past. It's to move on to another level where it moves the territories and the sovereignty such as it exists among Palestinians. It usurps it and decides to assert its own sovereignty over Palestinian areas. So this is just going even farther than ever before, and this is part of the creeping annexation and alteration. It's kind of like going to a new planet, let's say Mars, and terraforming it, making it suitable, making it like the Earth. What they're doing now is to take a country, a people, and a land of Palestine, and over the decades, it has been Israel has been increasing its Judaization, its Zionization, and completely transforming the places over which it has taken complete control. That's what all this is about. That's what the genocide is about. And it's always been a genocide for more than 100 years, a creeping genocide which was declared officially by the newly formed Zionist Congress in 1897. That's the way it's been ever since then. That's the direction that they're going in.
Well, there's a lot of recurring statements that have been made, Peter Ford, and of course many that have been repeated. But one of the ones that stands out amongst the few is this denial of Israel on Palestinians' right to self-determination. Can you please tell us why that is so important?
Well, the Palestinians are about the last people left in the world who were colonized. Every other ex-colony has seen the exercise of self-determination. So everywhere in the world, except in the case of Palestine, it's very embarrassing for Israelis to be reminded that they are effectively a Western colony which has been planted in the Middle East, and they are in the same position as those white South Africans were before Mandela came along and helped to achieve proper self-determination for South Africans. Self-determination is the strongest argument that the Palestinians have, and it's impossible to argue against it on legal grounds. This is why the United States this week in The Hague has been arguing that the court should leave on one side the legal arguments and consider only the practical consequences of the occupation and the need for negotiations under the aegis of the Security Council. And this brings us back to the law of the jungle. If it's just the powerful countries which are going to decide, then there is no point in having an ICJ or international law.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Taking a look at the U.S. role since our guest there mentioned that, Paula Rudy, I'm going to refer to the veto that has taken place on the ceasefire resolution. It's the only country to have done that, so you would think that the U.S. realizes now how isolated it really is. I mean, that speaks for itself. But while that has happened, which is on the third occasion, the first one to be on October 18, at that point, there were only a few thousand Palestinians that have been killed. From October 18 up to now, we're looking at almost 30,000. Doesn't that speak for itself in terms of what the U.S. has done?
Yes, and I think the U.S. is quite comfortable. Let's say the U.S. government, at least, is quite comfortable with that. What it says is we can do what we like. We can do it anywhere we like. We can do it as much as we like. And therefore, you need to adjust to that and to obey us, because we can destroy you. And see how we're destroying others through Israel. I mean, Israel is really an extension of the United States, or vice versa. So the United States doesn't mind the isolation, as long as they have the power. And that's, they're trying to impress the rest of the world with their power. It's very, they're saying, we're very dangerous, so be careful what you say and do. And it's pressing it for all it's worth everywhere in the world, but right now, especially in Palestine.
But don't you think this time, Peter Ford, that maybe because of the depth and the scale of the genocide that has taken place and the U.S. support for it in turn, that maybe it's not going to be as simple as the U.S. claiming the superiority that it has over the rest of the world, if you agree with what our guest there said?
That's right. And we're seeing the importance of military power here. But this time, it's not just U.S. military power. It's the power of the axis of resistance. And in the end, this is what will decide the outcome of the present crisis: the pressure from the north, from Hezbollah, the pressure from the south, from Ansar Allah, which is creating enormous economic havoc in Israel. The Israeli economy is shrinking at an annual rate of 20%. This is even worse than during the time of the COVID crisis. It's dramatic for Israel. For the first time in Israel's history, it's coming under serious economic pressure, and it's getting a taste of the sanctions which the Americans have enjoyed applying to Israel's enemies. This is where ultimately the crisis will be resolved, not in the Court of The Hague, unfortunately, although the outcome there will be useful, but it will be decided by a combination of military power, resistance, and the resistance of the people in Gaza, and the economic crisis that Israel is now experiencing.
It's very interesting, Paula Rudy, that you mentioned the fact that the U.S. likes to be singled out that way in terms of being the sole country that has actually used that veto. I'm curious as to why then they would go ahead and make a presentation at the UN for a ceasefire when it has vetoed one. Of course, it does have its precondition there for the release of the captives. But what do you make of that move by the U.S.? Is it trying to put a show in a matter of speaking? Because all of this comes on the what is said to be this imminent, either you call it a ground invasion or the slaughter of Palestinians in Rafah. I mean, what do you make of the U.S. move there?
Well, in part, the actions of the U.S. in the United Nations are the means of saying what I pointed out before. It's a means of saying, look, we have the power. We have the power not only on the ground, wherever we care to go with more than 800 bases and military installations throughout the world. We also have the power in the United Nations. We have a veto power, and we can twist arms of other countries in the UN. So this is the forum in which the United States uses its power. It's also, as you pointed out, a place where they can say, see, we're willing to be part of an international community and do things, but we have our limitations and we have our red lines and you need to abide by, we have to stay within those red lines in order to achieve anything supposedly together. Actually, it's being imposed by the United States. That's what it gets from working in the United Nations. I'm sure you know that the United States has said that it is, after vetoing the resolution proposed by Algeria, it says it's now working on a ceasefire resolution, which would be a temporary ceasefire and under conditions that are unlikely to be acceptable to the resistance.
So from that to the, I'm not too sure what to call it, Peter Ford, would you call it peace talks, truce talks, a pause in Cairo, Egypt, where the second round in all is going to be three, really, once that happens, where you have both Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, and Hamas, for that matter, also, in a sense, rejecting these talks at this point, but yet you have the other parties that are keen on moving forward. What do you make of that?
Well, it's pretty clear that the United States wants to achieve two things which are completely incompatible. On the one hand, it wants to spare the civilian population, or at least to appear to be trying to spare the civilian population. But at the same time, it wants Israel to be allowed to go in and totally crush, obliterate, destroy the resistance. These things cannot be reconciled. But it comes down to the issue of the hostages. At the end of the day, the sensible thing would be a deal, hostages for peace. But this cannot be achieved except in stages. That if the resistance hand over all the hostages now, which is what Israel and America and Britain are demanding, then Israel has no incentive to comply with a ceasefire. On the contrary, Israel would then have every incentive just to wade into Gaza and to hell with the consequences. As the only way forward, if there is to be any kind of deal over the hostages, is one which is phased, so that there would be a ceasefire, a partial return of the hostages, and then after a period of a few months, the remaining hostages would be allowed to return to Israel.
But based on a Palestinian statehood that the U.S. has suggested, along with its allies, Paul Larudi, which the Israeli prime minister has said, not on my watch, another one of the ministers says that's suicide, and I forget what the other extreme minister said about this, but they're totally against, that it's a gift to Hamas after Operation Al-Aqsa Flood.
Yes, I mean, Israel has said that it wants to eliminate, a requirement is to eliminate Hamas. That's absurd. Hamas is basically, it's a party. It's a part of the resistance. It's an idea in the minds of people who are seeking freedom and liberation and independence. And that's not going to go away. Hamas is going to exist no matter what. Israel is seeking a pretext for committing genocide. I think its real objective is demographic change. Right now, the number of Israeli Jews and the number of Palestinians in the territories controlled by Israel are roughly equal. And they don't want that, because they want to annex these territories, perhaps bit by bit, and sometimes in bigger chunks, as in Gaza. But in order to do that, they need to get rid of the population. I think their real objective is to is to get rid of the Palestinians, to get them into another area, or to wipe them off the face of the earth, or a little bit of both. But I think they're disingenuous when they talk about eliminating Hamas. They know they can't do that.
Yeah, I must say, on the issue of Palestinian statehood, Peter Ford, that Iran's leader has said that the solution to the Palestinian issue is resistance until a referendum becomes possible. But moving beyond that, let's look at the mere fact that you have the countries at the ICJ that have come out and pretty much all in chorus have blasted Israel for the apartheid practices that it has exercised in the occupied Palestinian lands. But it's a bit hypocritical for them to do that. But yet throughout the years and decades when they have been aware of these violations, they have done and conducted business with Israel. Doesn't that, the contribution that gives to Israel to keep doing what it's doing, a bit hypocritical from these countries?
Well, of course, the Western countries are completely hypocritical. And when they express support for a two-state solution, that is the height of cynicism, because these same countries have absolutely no intention whatsoever of putting any pressure on Israel so that it would concede a two-state solution. If they cannot even force Israel to stop a genocide, how can anyone possibly believe for a second that they will force the Israelis to give up the West Bank or to demolish even a single one of their settlements? Now, all this talk of a two-state solution is just pie in the sky. It's just meant for domestic consumption, to keep European and North American populations quiet, and to perhaps salve the consciences of the Western politicians. But the wiser Palestinians do not believe a word of it, and this is why they're more and more turning against the two-state solution, and they're looking more and more at one state between the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea.
Thank you very much, Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria. Paul LaRudy, thank you, co-founder of Free Palestine Movement and former U.S. government advisor. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitahui and the team, it's goodbye.